Right now, Donald Trump is the president, and he's going to try and leave his imprint on the Republican Party. And those of us who think that that would be a bad thing to happen have to make our case.
Hello, and welcome to Party Time, a mini-series from 538 looking at where the two major political parties are headed in the Trump era. I'm Galen Droog, podcast producer and reporter.
I'm politics reporter Claire Malone. Each week in February, we're talking to lawmakers, strategists, and stakeholders from different viewpoints within the two parties.
And last week, we talked to Trump's allies within the GOP. So this week, we're speaking with Republicans who are a little more wary of President Trump.
Look, I think that everybody who's a Republican can conceivably face some moral risk when it comes to Donald Trump at not speaking out.
My biggest line, the biggest, most prominent lines that I draw in the sand relate to the limits on the power of the federal government.
I still believe that the Republican Party doesn't have a future, and conservatism doesn't have a future in our country unless it appeals more to non-white voters.
Okay, Galen, are you ready to continue this adventure?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Before we dive into our conversations from this week, let's recap where we are in this series.
For sure. So our starting point last week was that Trump's rise has upended the conventional wisdom within the GOP. Starting with at least Reagan, the GOP has been made up of three main groups, as we discussed, and that's the social conservatives, the fiscal conservatives, and the foreign policy hawks. But now, with Trump's rise, he's created sort of new and yet to be defined divisions within the party.
Right. We've kind of been left with people who are pro-Trump and then the people who are kind of more wary of Trump, getting used to him. And last week, we actually talked to the pro-Trumpers, the people who are welcoming the changes that are going on in the party right now. And one of those people, for example, was an immigration reduction advocate. And he said that Republicans basically hadn't paid any attention to his ideas until now.
Right, Mark Krikorian.
Right. But, of course, the classic elements of the Republican Party haven't totally disappeared either.
Yeah, they're still there. And as you said, many of them are somewhat wary of Trump and the direction that he's taking the party in. And when you look at those people, they fall into more or less one of two groups of Republicans.
Okay, lay that out for us. Paint a picture.
So on one hand, we have the John McCains and Lindsey Grahams of the party. You might call them the establishment. They tend to be concerned with America's place in the world, and they advocate things like a strong military and free trade. I mean, another example is the Bushes didn't endorse Donald Trump during the election.
And so the other group is the constitutional conservatives, right?
Yeah. And that's the more Tea Party-esque wing of the party. So they're focused on a small federal government, the separation of powers. They would identify with the Freedom Caucus in Congress. And that's people like Senator Ben Sasse or Representative Justin Amash.
So now, just to get a sense of those perspectives, we're speaking with three different people this week. We've got first up Pete Wehner, who worked in both Bush administrations and for Ronald Reagan. There's Senator Mike Lee from Utah. And then we've got Ramesh Panaru, who's a senior editor for National Review and a leader of the Reform Conservative Movement.
Let's dive in. As you mentioned, our first conversation is with Pete Wehner, who worked for the past three Republican administrations before Trump. And in the George W. Bush White House, he was deputy director of speechwriting and then later the head of the Office of Strategic Initiatives. So I think you could say that that probably qualifies him as part of the establishment.
I'd say.
And so now he's a senior fellow at the conservative think tank, the Ethics and Public Policy Center.
And so we started out by asking him about the policy direction of the Trump administration.
I think it's very difficult to know in terms of policy and philosophically what the contours are going to be, because I think that Donald Trump is philosophically and ideologically rootless. I don't think that he has any coherent view of the world. A lot of his views are sui generis, they're episodic, they're erratic, and he changes positions from day to day or week to week. I think what you can predict with some degree of confidence is on the temperamental and characterological side, and that's always been the area that's worried me the most. He is a person who is erratic and crude and cruel and vindictive and impulsive. And he has very little self-discipline, no apparent self-awareness, no self-restraints. So I think we're going to get a lot of trouble. And we also know about Donald Trump that when he's criticized and he has very, very thin skin, he goes on the attack all the time. And so my guess is that as he is buffeted by events, he's going to lash out more and more, and he's going to create enemies, create new enemies, and there's going to be this constant conflict and constant tension that characterizes his presidency, and that I think will over time and soon exhaust much of the public.
I'm wondering what you see as going down the garden path. Is it Pence and Bannon who will be exerting the most power? Is it one or the other? Is there one to be more worried about? Is it okay to have the Mike Pencean shadow presidency versus the Steve Bannon shadow presidency?
It's impossible to know because Trump is such a chaotic figure, and he governs chaotically and he acts chaotically. So I think these things will shift from week to week and month to month. I do think that Steve Bannon is going to be an extremely influential force in the White House. I think he's the ideological leader of the Trump White House. And I think he's going to engage in, among other things, a full-throated assault on conservatism and replace what is traditional conservatism with a kind of ethnic nationalism. And I think we've seen that in all sorts of ways. The most recent executive order as it relates to Muslims is one. The inaugural address that he wrote with Steve Miller is another.
You mentioned Steve Bannon's ethnic nationalism, and his ideology was very much a factor in Trump's campaign. So it's not exactly a surprise. So what attracted your party to Donald Trump with Steve Bannon as that ideological force?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think the first thing to say is that a lot of the party was not particularly attracted to Donald Trump. He had a lot of resistance throughout the primary, but he did win the nomination. It wasn't easy, but he did win it, and there was never a candidate who was able to coalesce the anti-Trump forces sufficiently to stop him. In terms of what was the appeal to Trump in the Republican Party and on the right, it's a complicated set of issues, I suspect. One of it is kind of white-hot anger, ferocious anger that a lot of people on the right have toward what they refer to as the establishment, the political class, frustration with blue-collar workers, that they felt like not only that their needs weren't being met and the problems they were facing weren't being dealt with, but they felt like they weren't being heard. And beyond that, they felt dishonored and disrespected by the political class. And they saw in Donald Trump a kind of wrecking ball to the political establishment, a person who, when he spoke, they seemed to feel like he was speaking for them.
What role has your wing of the party, the more establishment Republican, what role has that wing played in Trump's rise or any of the anger that is on the right?
The reality is that there were these problems facing blue-collar voters that simply weren't addressed. Now, some number of people on the right were writing and talking about these issues long before Donald Trump ever got onto the stage. But for the most part, the Republican Party as an institution didn't deal with these problems. And part of that was an ideological straitjacket that I think it had imposed on itself. The shadow of Ronald Reagan was so large, the personality and presidency of Ronald Reagan was so influential that a lot of establishment Republicans kept repeating the same Reagan programs and the same Reagan lines, acting as if every day was January 20th, 1981. And the world has gone on and the problems are different. The challenges are different, but the Republican Party, to some large extent, didn't adjust to that. So these people felt like they'd been left behind in the modern economy and the modern culture, and they felt like Republicans or Democrats, nobody was really addressing their concerns. And so they looked elsewhere, and in this case, the elsewhere was a man by the name of Trump.
How do principled conservatives and moderate Republicans gain back control of the party? Do you think it's possible?
Well, I do think it's possible. You know, nothing in politics lasts forever, and straight line extrapolations never work because events intervene.
So I guess specifically, like, you know, what is the message? Who is your base? What's the plan?
Well, look, I think right now the plan is for people to make their case in a principled way. You can't force events. And right now, Donald Trump is the president. And he's going to try and leave his imprint on the Republican Party. And those of us who think that that would be a bad thing to happen have to make our case. Right now, we may not get much of a hearing because he's the president and he's got control of the House and the Senate. And Republicans, lawmakers, are not inclined to go crosswise of him. On the other hand, events will unfold. And he's gotten off to a rocky start. He took office as the lowest rated president in modern times. And I can promise you that if Trump's popularity goes down and he becomes a drag on Republicans in the House and the Senate, and they begin to think that their own election prospects are going to be pulled down by Trump, you will see them quicker than a blink of an eye begin to turn on him.
To what extent do you think Republicans should work with Democrats to block Donald Trump when he goes against conservative values?
Well, if he goes against conservative values, certainly if he goes against the Constitution or the laws, I think they should work with Democrats.
Is this first immigration ban an example where you think Republicans should work with Democrats?
Yeah, I think so. I think that they should work with Democrats to reverse it, or at least to, if Trump is going to go forward with a ban, to make it a responsible ban, not to have it a ban that's certainly oriented toward Muslims.
Well, Pete, let's talk about Paul Ryan. This guy came up as the classic conservative ideas man, took a stand against what he called, or earlier in the campaign, Trump's proposal that essentially proffered a religious test for refugees or for immigration. Now he's noticeably silent on Trump's very controversial executive order. What do we make of Paul Ryan? What do you, as a conservative, make of Paul Ryan right now in the way he's dealing with the Trump presidency?
Well, Ryan faces a real challenge, and Paul is a friend. I've known him for many years, and I respect him tremendously as an individual and as a conservative thinker and as a legislator. I think he has an extremely difficult task right now, which is that he's got a dysfunctional president that he has to deal with. And I think his challenge is to try and contain Trump, to contain the worst instincts and the worst actions of Trump, and try and channel him and channel his presidency in a constructive way. And that's not easy. Paul Ryan is in a different position than I am. I can unload on Donald Trump all I want.
Does Paul Ryan risk losing a moral high ground in any way as a political leader? I understand the idea of a person needing to help channel politics, but is there a threshold where it becomes too much and that Paul Ryan risks wounding himself in the long term by going along with some of Trump's more erratic or not well thought through policy?
Look, I think that everybody who's a Republican can conceivably face some moral risk when it comes to Donald Trump and not speaking out. That is that he can act in ways that are so malicious and so pernicious that it's going to require people to speak out. The question is, when does he do it? What is that threshold? And reasonable and responsible people are going to draw that line in different places. I drew mine a long time ago. Others will draw it at a different place. Is the ban on immigration and Muslims a line that all Republicans should speak out about? They're going to have to decide that for themselves. I think it's one that you do need to speak out on. But this isn't the only time that Paul Ryan or anybody else is going to have an opportunity to speak out about Donald Trump. These are going to happen all the time. And Ryan and Mitch McConnell and every other Republican is going to have to try and figure out what their footing is. I understand your question and I accept some of the premises in it. But on the other hand, I understand too that there are people on the Hill who are Republicans who are going to have to deal with Donald Trump. That's why, if somebody asked me if they should work in a Trump administration, I could never do it, but I hope some responsible people do, because someone has to govern this country. And there have to be Republicans on Capitol Hill who have bridges to Trump and the Trump administration to try and make sure that this ship doesn't tip over. And that means that they're not at liberty to speak out on every issue and criticize Trump like people like I can.
Do you think Trump will have a primary challenge for 2020? And if so, who might that be? What might that person look like within the Republican vein of things?
I have no idea. It's just impossible to know, because so much of it depends on circumstances that we can't anticipate. It depends, of course, in large measure on whether he fails or succeeds as a president. And then if he fails, it depends on how he fails. What areas does he fail in? Because the areas that he might fail in would dictate what kind of person might challenge him. Is it in foreign policy? Is it in domestic policy? Does it have to do with tone? Does it have to do with bigotry and race? Does it have to do with all of those things? So we'll see. My prediction is that Trump as a president will fail. Now, for the sake of the country, I hope he succeeds. When I say I hope he succeeds, I hope he succeeds with policies that spur prosperity and heal the country and help advance human dignity and human flourishing. Where I hope he doesn't succeed is in advancing a Steve Bannon and Steve Miller kind of agenda, his sort of hyper-ethnic nationalism. And if that happens, I think it'll be bad for conservatism, bad for the Republican Party, and bad for the Republic.
Claire, so clearly Pete Wehner is not happy with President Trump. Just for some more background for listeners, he rejected Trump early on in the primary. He didn't vote for him in the general election. And as he put it, his biggest concern with Trump is character.
Right. And then when it comes to ideology, Pete Wehner said he doesn't think Trump has much of one. He actually pointed to Steve Bannon as the guy with the guiding ideology in the White House right now. And he described that ideology as ethnic nationalism.
I think, yeah, that's something that the left has been saying, but not really something that we've heard from people on the right. And as a Republican who is identifying Bannon in that way, we asked him why he thought Republicans voted for Trump given that background ideology of Steve Bannon. And he said that he thought it was in response to being left out of the modern economy and modern culture, and that ultimately that had caused a lot of anger towards the political class. But, you know, this is a question that we've been asking for a while, certainly throughout the campaign. You know, how much of Trump's attraction is based on economic disenfranchisement and how much of his attraction is based on racial resentment?
Yeah, that's something that the party has to grapple with. And we at 538 have looked into this using data.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, Nate Silver, our boss, looked at exit poll and census data during the primary, and he found that Trump voters were actually better off economically than the median U.S. household. And various other studies have suggested that views on race did play a role in the election.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, the data also shows that economic anxiety, worry about the future, does track with Trump support.
And that's economic anxiety as opposed to economic hardship. So economic anxiety, looking towards the future, economic hardship, your situation right now.
Correct. Evidence suggests that racial resentments play a role in Trump support and that economic anxiety also plays a role. Both are evident. The question is in what proportions?
Yeah. So moving forward, it will be interesting to see how Republicans who agree with Pete Wehner counter Trump's message. Are they going to be talking about an alternative economic path? How much are they going to be talking about inclusion when it comes to race and religion is something that we'll be looking at.
Right. And looking forward, I will say that one thing that stuck out to me is that when we asked how establishment Republicans or principled conservatives might regain control of the party, he said that they'd have to wait for the right political moment.
Mm-hmm.
So basically waiting for Trump to mess up on his own, as opposed to trying to proactively shift the conversation.
Yeah. And not to give too much away about later episodes, but that was something that was more or less echoed by establishment Democrats that we spoke with, sort of accepting the cycle of politics and waiting for the right moment to reassert your message or values.
Right. Okay. Next up is Senator Mike Lee from Utah. But first, a word from this week's sponsor.
Valentine's is all about capturing that wow factor that leaves a lasting impression. You always remember when one of your colleagues around Valentine's Day gets that big, beautiful bouquet of flowers. There's no way to wow without 1-800-Flowers. As your rose authority, 1-800-Flowers has the best deals on Valentine's essentials. 1-800-Flowers has a wide selection of beautiful rose bouquets and arrangements. And the best part is they start at $29.99. With a radiant mix of red, petal pink, and hot pink roses, this enchanted bouquet is guaranteed to wow. Simply pick your delivery date and let 1-800-Flowers handle the rest. 1-800-Flowers has exclusive offers for Party Time listeners. Today's offer is 18 enchanted roses for just $29.99. That's a 45% discount, but they're only available while supplies last. Every bouquet is packed with their 100% smile guarantee. And if your loved one has any issue, 1-800-Flowers will make it right. To get an amazing Valentine's deal like 18 enchanted roses for only $29.99, go to 1-800-Flowers.com, click the radio icon, and enter code PARTY. That's 1-800-Flowers.com, click the radio icon, and enter code PARTY. Okay, we're back. We have the chance to talk to Senator Mike Lee from Utah. As far as political identity goes, I'd say he falls into the category of constitutional conservative. He's one of three people in Congress with a 100% liberty score from Conservative Review, and the only senator with that distinction.
He did not endorse Trump during the election, but is interested in working with him on areas of agreement going forward. We started by asking Senator Lee how Trump's election has changed the direction of the GOP.
Well, it's changed the direction of the GOP in the sense that, first of all, he won. And that's a different outcome than we've had in the two preceding presidential election cycles. And having won, we now have a tremendous opportunity to go back and restore some limits to federal power, especially executive power. And our attention has been focused on those things now in a way that it hasn't been in the past, in part because we've seen so much concentration of power in the last 8 years under the Obama administration. And I think the American people, not just Republicans, but Americans from across the political spectrum, are ready to restore constitutional limits that are designed to protect us against that very kind of accumulation of power.
Senator, you did not endorse President Trump during the campaign, but, you know, obviously your party's won. I'm wondering if you can tell us what you think the priorities of the GOP are under this new administration.
I think consistent with President Trump's message, and yeah, you're right, President Trump and I had our differences along the way, but he has won now, and he won quite effectively with a message that told people, look, America's poor middle class are having a tough time, the rich and well-connected are getting along great. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that too much power has accumulated in Washington and has been given to government bureaucrats. To put this in perspective, you know, in 2016, Congress passed and the president signed 2,966 pages of new laws, while federal agencies issued 97,110 pages of new regulations, about 32 times as much. I have a visual display showing this in my office, and I talk about it in my book, Our Lost Constitution. You know, the stack of regulations is 11 or 12 feet tall. The stack of laws is just a few inches tall. It's a big difference between these two sets of laws, because although they both contain legally binding requirements and norms, the large set of documents was put in place by unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats. And it's the smaller set that's put in place by people who were actually elected by the people to make law.
Right. And what you're kind of expressing there is a traditional conservative point of view. I want to pull this a little bit, you know, 30,000 feet up. Are there any wings of Trump's Republican Party? Are there any new wings, any distinguishable separations within the party under this president?
You know, I'm not sure I would say new wings so much as I would say there's a new focus, there's a new concentration of emphasis in that President Trump has said he wants to return power to the people. I take him at his word on this. I'm going to work tirelessly with him to return more power to the people and to the states in areas like health care and education and welfare and transportation. And in the separation of powers area that I was just discussing, you know, we're going to move towards rebalancing the separation of powers by passing reforms like the RAINS Act, which would require approval from Congress before any regulation costing more than $100 million a year can go into effect. President Trump has said he's supportive of this bill and this type of effort. So these are examples of the kinds of things that he will do in order to return power to the people. And so it's this populist message, what some might call the populist wing of the party. I wouldn't really call it a new wing because it is such a significant part of who we are as Republicans now that it's better characterized as the fuselage than the wing.
You mentioned that Donald Trump is putting a renewed emphasis on the working class and that you're interested in working with him in that aspect going forward. Do you feel like the Republican Party had lost the working class somewhere along the way during the past Republican administrations? I mean, is that a pivot from where the party was, say, a decade or two ago?
Yes, that's a great question. I absolutely think that is something we lost as a party. I'm not sure exactly when it happened, but I do know that sometime in the last couple of decades, we lost that emphasis on hardworking Americans, on poor middle-class Americans. And somehow we almost seem to accept, perhaps, with some Republicans wearing as a badge of honor almost, this badly manipulated caricature of Republicans being the party of the top 1% or the party of the country club elites. And we're not. We are at our best when we're focusing on protecting America's poor and middle class by restoring protections in the Constitution.
And so, you know, that's a place where your ideas align with the president. But there are definitely some areas where principled conservatives in the House and Senate aren't going to agree, right? When it comes to $1 trillion in infrastructure or a new foreign policy of isolationism. When it comes to those points where, you know, principled conservatism does not align with the president, how is the Senate, for example, going to work through them?
I think each instance will present its own set of challenges. With infrastructure, for example, that's a great one to bring up because we're still not sure what that's going to look like. We've heard from some people in the president's administration, including Wilbur Ross, that this is going to be private money, that this is somehow going to come together without the need for federal tax dollars being invested. I can't wait to find out how that's going to work. And if that is the case, then there will be a lot fewer concerns among conservative Republicans. If, on the other hand, we're talking about a massive, potentially trillion-dollar new investment in infrastructure, there are going to be a lot of us who have some real questions and concerns about where that's going to come from.
We spoke with Pete Wehner, and he obviously worked for Reagan and both Bushes, and he said the way he put it to us was that every lawmaker is going to have a different threshold for where they might reject Trump, where they see a division between Trump and traditional conservative values. And I'm wondering, do you have any sort of lines in the sand now that he's president?
Yeah, my biggest lines, the biggest, most prominent lines that I draw in the sand relate to the limits on the power of the federal government, in particular the structural protections outlined in the Constitution, the horizontal protection we call separation of powers, recognizing the distinct role of each independent coordinate branch in the federal government. And then their vertical protection that we call federalism, the notion that the federal government was always designed to be a government possessing powers that Madison described as few and defined. And he referred to the powers reserved to the states as numerous and indefinite. Those are the most important touchstones as I see it. And anytime I see those thresholds transgressed, I'm going to have a lot of concerns that are going to have to be addressed.
Can you think of any issue areas where that might crop up?
Okay, so a good example of this might be trade. The Tariff Act of 1930 and the Trade Act of 1974 both give a lot of power to the President of the United States to change trade policy, to increase tariffs or impose tariff-like remedies on international trade in response to changing trade circumstances. I think that's giving the chief executive too much power. Mm-hmm. And this is without regard to who happens to be the president at the time. This is part of my theme, part of the same argument as to why I believe we need the RAINS Act, a piece of legislation which President Trump himself supports. Congress ought to be approving those things. Congress ought to be passing, enacting changes to law, changes to U.S. policy that have significant impacts like that. And so I don't necessarily know that that will be 100% at odds with where President Trump wants to go. Maybe he'll be just fine with restoring constitutional protections in that area. But that said, he has said that he would like to take steps, perhaps on his own, in some of these areas, like trade, like imposing tariffs. So I can see that being a potential area of conflict.
You have been an outspoken advocate of the Constitution during your time in the Senate, and the views that you've expressed here are not necessarily views that we've heard across the board from Republicans in the Senate or in the House. So,
well,
I guess,
in my small town of Alpine, Utah, we speak of little else other than federalism and separation of power.
But I guess I'm wondering, are there enough people like you in Congress to form a coalition that can challenge the president on these kinds of issues?
Sure. You're right in that our coalition is still a small one. It's not necessarily one that controls all of the votes in Congress or not even all the Republican votes in either house of Congress. But we are a growing movement. When I got here just a few years ago, there weren't all that many people talking about federalism and separation of powers. And I can tell you in both the House and the Senate, there are a whole lot of us who are now. And every time you add one person who's willing to talk about these things relentlessly, a whole bunch of others pop up who suddenly decide that it's time to come out of the woodwork and talk about it themselves. It's making a lot of headway, very quickly, in part because this really is quite consistent with much of what Donald Trump wants to do.
And beyond just the concept of federalism, Senators McCain and Graham have spoken out against the Trump administration on issues such as the immigration ban. And Senator McCain called the Australian ambassador to the U.S. to reiterate our country's support for Australia after hearing of Trump's exchange. So are there going to be different groups within the Republican majority that are kind of breaking with the president in different ways? Is there going to be almost this like parallel Republican government in a sense?
Yeah, I wouldn't describe it that way. I think there is a fantasy on the part of some Democrats that sees it that way. But I don't think that's really accurate. Look, it's not entirely unheard of for some members of the president's party serving in Congress to disagree with some of the president's policies. That's, in fact, fairly common. And in my opinion, in both parties, it should be more common than it is. I can't tell you the number of times when during the last presidential administration, especially when the Democrats were still in the majority in the Senate, I would sometimes have Democratic colleagues approach me and, speaking in hushed tones, would tell me, hey, I'm glad you're speaking out against X or Y or Z. I think it's important for us to defend our own institutional prerogatives as lawmakers. And I'd say, that's great. I appreciate it. But, you know, why are we whispering? And I think it's healthy when members of Congress, Republicans or Democrats, senators or congressmen, are willing to speak out and express independent thoughts separate and apart from what leaders in their party or the president of the United States himself might be embracing at the time.
In speaking with conservative thinkers about Donald Trump, one of the biggest criticisms has not even been so much about policy as it has been about character. Conservatives have long promoted strong moral values as part of their doctrine. So how do conservatives now promote those moral values given some of Trump's behavior?
The same way we did before, the same way we have always tried to. Each one of us has to do our own part. And look, the fact that we've got a new president with his own unique personality, with his own unique talents and his own unique challenges, just like anyone else, neither excuses anyone else in departing from what we believe to be right, but, you know, sort of continues to remind us of the fact that each of us has to stand behind what we believe is the right thing to do.
Do you think if by the time the next primary season rolls along and movement conservatives feel that Trump hasn't done enough for them, do you think that there will be a primary challenge to the president?
Oh, stop. It's way too early to do that. This guy has just barely been sworn into office. I mean, less than 2 weeks ago. It's way too early to ask that. Look, I had my differences with Mr. Trump during 2016. He is our president now, and I want to do everything I can to support him insofar as he pursues an agenda of restoring constitutionally limited government, and I intend to do precisely that.
So, Galen, the way Pete Wehner put it earlier is, Donald Trump is president, and Republican lawmakers, even if they disagree with him on certain things, have to figure out how to work with him. I think some of those sentiments were echoed by Senator Lee.
One piece of that dynamic that will be interesting to see play out is, as Senator Lee mentioned, the coalition of constitutional conservatives has been growing in recent years. But of course, that's been under the Obama administration, when many Republicans disagreed with the actions coming out of the executive branch. So now, with a Republican in the White House, will that wing of the party continue to grow? And if so, will they stand up to Trump, or will they get Trump on board with their message?
That plays into a key question for the Republican Party right now, which is, when Donald Trump breaks with party policy, what is the threshold where lawmakers will begin to dissent? For Senator Lee, at least one of those lines is on tariffs.
Yeah, free trade has been the name of the game for the mainstream within both parties. But now, both Trump and the Sanders wing of the Democratic Party are sort of challenging that. So will the main defenders of free trade emerge within the Democratic Party or the Republican Party? Both? Neither? It remains to be seen.
If President Trump does actually try to levy tariffs, that seems like a place where we could see Democrats and Republicans come together in opposition. Or on the other hand, if one of the parties adamantly rejects free trade, that will be a clear shift in identity for that party.
Okay, Up next is Ramesh Ponnuru. He is a senior editor for National Review and a leader within the reform conservative movement.
We started off by asking him how Republicans should respond when Trump challenges the party line.
What conservatives need to do is pick and choose. So, for example, E-Verify, making E-Verify mandatory for new hires to ensure that illegal immigrants are not being hired against the law. That's one thing. Building a wall is one thing. A ban on Muslims is something where I think congressional Republicans should draw the line. But I think that that's the general approach that conservatives should take about Trump's position on a range of issues.
We've seen a lot of astounding numbers about the way that the Republican grassroots feel radically different about certain issues that were once Republican orthodoxy. You know, free trade is one of them. There's been a radical swing between last year and this year, how Republicans feel about that. Is picking and choosing issues, does that sort of dilute conservative ideology in the long run?
I wouldn't want to see the identity of conservatism transform too much in a Trumpian way. But I think it's important for conservatives, and really for everybody, not to overestimate the depths of the roots of any ideology in voter sentiment. Mm-hmm. Voters just are not highly ideological and really don't spend their time trying to come up with a coherent philosophy of government to guide their political behavior. And I do think that one of the reasons Trump triumphed is that there was a kind of conservative self-delusion about this, about the idea that your typical Republican voter was just hell-bent on free trade and mm-hmm. entitlement reform and limited government.
But what about if those people start electing congressmen and women who have the same sort of cafeteria-style approach to Republicanism, picking and choosing what they want? Is that a worry going forward?
Well, a certain loosening of rigid ideological restraints among Republicans wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. I guess there are a couple questions. One is there going to be an actual class of Trumpian Republicans who are running and winning primaries? So far, there really haven't been mm-hmm. such candidates. And to the extent anybody's even tried to run as a kind of mini Trump, they've gotten slaughtered. I mean, if you look at the primary challenges to Paul Ryan in his Wisconsin congressional district and Marco Rubio in the Florida Senate primary, they got massacred. I think the bigger question is going to be whether sort of all of the existing Republican officials just kind of dilute their own mm-hmm. message to get along with the person who happens to be the president of the United States. And right now, that looks like it's a pretty serious possibility. But I think that our view may be a little bit distorted because while Trump may not be enjoying a standard honeymoon, because nothing about Trump has been standard, I do think he's at sort of the peak of his influence, where Republican voters and even Republican elected officials are just sort of amazed that he won and grateful that yeah. he won. And as time goes on, there may be a little bit more resistance and kind of inertia where Republicans decide they're going to keep doing what they're doing.
What about the issue of public decorum? Do we come to a point where people just no longer have the patience or appetite for somebody who is as heavy-handed on Twitter as Trump?
One of the deep sadnesses of this election was the extent to which conservatives completely abandoned everything we used to say about the importance of character in a leader. It was one thing for people to say they were going to vote for him, even though he had some serious deficiencies on that front because of all the other things that were on the ballot. But too many people basically just ignored this issue altogether or came up with rationalizations like, well, nobody's perfect. And the polling on evangelicals just from 2011 to now about whether character matters in a leader, that's one of the things where the numbers have completely changed based on the partisan tides.
In listening to you talk about the way that voters decide who to vote for and how there's maybe some daylight between their actual preferences and the staunch conservatism that we're familiar with, I mean, then what is driving Trump's voters? I mean, is there a conservative base anymore?
Well, your typical Trump voter was a person who also voted for Mitt Romney and voted for John McCain before him. So we shouldn't overstate the distinctiveness of his general election win. I think there is a Republican base, but I think it's better thought of as a coalition. And to radically simplify, I think it has three basic groupings within it. One is what we've taken to calling the Tea Partiers over the last few years. Another way of thinking about this group, it's these are the voters who will describe themselves to pollsters as very conservative. Then there are the more sort of Chamber of Commerce Republicans who are a little bit more moderate, less ideological, and pro-business. And then the third group, which had always been present in the Republican Party, but has been a growing element of the Republicans and which was organized and activated for the first time by Donald Trump, I think of them as working class nationalists. These are typically, though not exclusively, white voters without college degrees. They're skeptical of trade. They're very concerned about unchecked immigration and particularly illegal immigration. They're not liberals, but they would worry about entitlement reform. They would worry about just getting rid of Obamacare without putting anything in its place. And I think that the challenge for Republicans is going to be to integrate that group and really sort of weave those three groups together into a majority coalition.
Those preferences don't sound compatible. You're a well-known conservative thinker. I mean, what do you want the path forward to look like?
Well, I think that conservatives are going to have to find ways that don't violate our philosophy or that are compatible with our philosophy to address the concerns of that working class group, their concerns about their standard of living and about stagnant wages. One thing that I think that Republicans haven't given enough attention to is higher education reform, but really that's kind of a narrow way of phrasing it. I think we need to think about ways to expand opportunity for people who are not going to traditional four-year brick-and-mortar college institutions, whether that be maybe taking some of the money that we send to those institutions and using it on apprenticeships, maybe changing the number and kind of those institutions by loosening up the accreditation process, creating new ways of financing higher education. If Republicans were to devote serious attention to applying conservative philosophy in ways that respond to these problems, these middle class and lower middle class problems, I think there are a lot of places you could do that. I just think Republicans haven't been particularly oriented to those problems until very, very recently.
One of your groups was the sort of working class nationalists. And as you pointed out, a lot of them are white. After Mitt Romney's election, there was that whole postmortem where the Republicans said, listen, for the long-term health of the party, we need to invite more minorities in and make them feel more welcome. Are you worried about the long-term future of the Republican Party as far as electoral math goes? I think Trump is seen as, frankly, a hostile figure by a lot of minority communities.
I still believe that the Republican Party doesn't have a future, and conservatism doesn't have a future in our country unless it appeals more to non-white voters. If conservatism takes the path that I'm advocating, where we work harder at addressing the concerns of people who are not spending a lot of time in executive boardrooms, that I think creates the potential for not just picking up working class white voters, but also picking up a lot of Hispanic voters, picking up some black voters. And these are changes that have to take place on the margin. You don't have to get majorities of these groups in order to make some progress. I do think that the imperative to do it is still there over the long run. And one way that this election could prove Pyrrhic ultimately is if Republicans decide that it proves that they don't need to make inroads among non-white voters. And I'd also add among non-Christian voters.
Do you think that's something that some people are thinking, like, well, let's just try to win all the white people, to put it flatly?
You do hear some discussion of a kind of white strategy, partly because there was a kind of single-minded obsession with the Hispanic vote and with immigration as the key to that vote that I think was always a wrong-headed way of looking at it.
Claire, that's a wrap on the group of people that we've been calling the Republicans wary of Trump. Do we have a better sense of where the Republican Party is headed?
Great question. No, looking back on the three conversations we had, I think one common thread is a sense that the Republican Party forgot about the working class, or at least didn't adapt its message to deal with working class challenges. And there's a sense among conservatives that they need to change that in order to respond to Trump's rise and to maybe regain control of the party.
Yeah, that is one of the clear shifts I think we're seeing in party identity, right? Senator Lee brought up the country club Republicans or the one percenter image, which he sees as misguided. And if we can for a second reflect on Mitt Romney's campaign in 2012, for example, it was all about small business owners. But, you know, as it turns out, and as we've heard from the people we spoke to, not everybody is a small business owner, and that's not necessarily an economic message that's going to resonate.
Right. Trump has shifted the direction of the party, and probably not just within his wing. Yes, his own policies tend to be more isolationist on foreign policy, protectionist on trade, maybe even populist. And that's a clear break on his part from Republican orthodoxy. But he's also shifted the conversation among those longtime conservatives. There's now a concerted effort on their part to apply conservative values to the challenges of working people, or at the very least, to message to them.
And so the question is, will that work with the modern Republican voters who overwhelmingly support President Trump? If Trump's support is more about nationalism and racial resentment, then an economic-centered message from Trump-wary Republicans might not actually work. But if his support is more about economic anxiety, then maybe Trump-wary Republicans can push a more inclusive and working-class-focused message.
So how much of that new economic message will be a real part of the GOP identity going forward? Only time will tell. Clearly, Democrats are trying to oppose that shift in identity by saying it's not genuine, pointing to Trump's cabinet, for example, saying it's focused on corporate interests.
And speaking of Democrats, that is where we're headed next week. In our next episode, we'll take a look at the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And here's a preview.
I mean, this party is gone, and there has to be a revitalized Democratic Party. It's over. I mean, the party's over. And they've got to get that. And new blood has to come in, and people with vision and passion and inspiration.
I see hats that say, oh, America's already great. And, you know, I'm a progressive, and I'm not sure that I always feel that way. I think that there's a lot of things that are happening, and there's a lot of voter frustration. And we need to speak to that.
Okay, and that's for next Thursday. More party time. I'm Claire Malone.
And I'm Galen Druk. Micah Cohen is our amazing politics editor. Jody Avergan and Chadwick Matlin are our podcast editors. Jorge Estrada is in the control room. And Kara Chin is our intern. Production help this week from Colleen Leahy and Sarah Melton.
Get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also tweet at us with questions or comments.
There's more information about this series and a partial transcript on our website, 538.com/podcasts. And if you missed last week's episode, you can find it there as well.
If you're a fan of the show, leave a rating or a review in iTunes. When you leave a rating, it helps our rankings, which helps others discover the show.
That's a wrap. We'll see you next time for more Party Time!